Chapter 10 Your Government Dealing Drugs. The incident, the Iran-Contra scandal of 1986-88, involved members of the Reagan administration breaking an arms embargo and selling weapons to Iran in order to secure the release of 6 U.S. hostages and to fund the Nicaraguan Contras. The official word, 14 administration officials were charged with crimes, and 11 were convicted. Reagan eventually admitted trading arms for hostages. My take? Congress covered up the fact that illegal drug deals were at the heart of the Iran-Contra story, just as the CIA has been deeply involved in drug trafficking for decades. It's a situation that continues today in Mexico and Afghanistan, and the reality is that our economy is secretly deeply embedded in the global drug trade. But what's important in this whole thing is that our policy has always been consistent. Oliver North, interviewed on Frontline, The Drug Wars, PBS. One of the reasons I'm writing this book is because our country has such a short-term memory. How many of us recall that as far back as 1972, a report of the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse recommended that possession of pot for personal use be decriminalized. And that was when Nixon was president. Later on, Jimmy Carter called for getting rid of penalties for small-time possession, but Congress stonewalled him. Since then, we've had another president, Clinton, who claimed he didn't inhale, and our latest, Obama, admitting he took some tokes in his day. Federal law still considers marijuana a dangerous illegal drug, although 14 states have now enacted laws allowing for some use for medical purposes. Let me cite a few statistics that I find mind-boggling. According to NORML, an advocacy group for legalizing marijuana, more than 700,000 of America's estimated 20 million pot smokers got arrested in 2008. About half the 200,000 inmates in our federal prisons are in there for drug-related offenses. Between 1970 and 2007, we saw a 547% increase in our prison population, mainly because of our drug policies. Of course, that's just fine with the new prison industrial complex, where corporations are now running the show. We, as taxpayers, shell out $68 billion every year for prisons, and a lot of that ends up going into private contractors' pockets. Of course, they're not the only ones getting rich. Well-documented reports by Congress and the Treasury Department lead to the conclusion that American banks are collectively the world's largest financial beneficiary of the drug trade. Not including real estate transfers, there's an estimated inflow of $250 billion a year coming into the country's banks, which I suppose is welcomed by some as offsetting our $300 billion trade deficit. We'll talk more about banks several times in this chapter, but I want to start with some history on our government's involvement with drug traffic. You want to talk hypocrisy? This sordid saga takes the cake. We started using drug lords like Lucky Luciano to help fight the communists back during World War II. The OSS, predecessor to the CIA, had the Sicilian Mafia and the Corsican gangsters in Marseille working with them, which enabled their key role in the growth of Europe's post-war heroin traffic, which provided most of the heroin smuggled into the United States over the next two decades. The heroin epidemic that ravaged our cities during the 50s and 60s basically originated with the CIA out of Southeast Asia. Almost from the moment of their founding in 1947, the CIA was giving covert support to organized drug traffickers in Europe and the Far East, eventually the Middle East and Latin America. During the Vietnam War, hold on to your hats, heroin was being smuggled into this country in the bodies of soldiers being flown home, coded ahead of time so they could be identified at various Air Force bases and the drugs removed. Toward the end of American involvement over there in 1975, a former Green Beret named Michael Hand arranged a 500-pound shipment of heroin from Southeast Asia's Golden Triangle to the U.S. by way of Australia. That's where Hand had set up shop as vice chair of the Nugan Hand Bank, which was linked by the Australian Narcotics Bureau to a drug smuggling network that exported some $3 billion Australian dollars worth of heroin from Bangkok prior to June 1976. Several CIA guys who later came up in the Iran-Contra affair, Ted Shackley, Ray Klines, and Edwin Wilson, used the Nugan Hand Bank to channel funds for covert operations. By 1979, the bank had 22 branches in 13 countries and $1 billion in annual business. The next year, Chairman Frank Nugan was found shot dead in his Mercedes, 100 miles from Sydney, and the bank soon collapsed. Two official investigations by Australia uncovered its financing of major drug dealers and the laundering of their profits, while collecting an impressive list of ex-CIA officers. After the CIA's involvement with the Southeast Asian drug trade had been partly disclosed in the mid-1970s, and the U.S. left Vietnam to its fate, the agency started distancing itself from its assets. But that only left the door open to go elsewhere, which the Reagan administration did big time to fund its secret war in Nicaragua. The 1979 Sandinista Revolution that overthrew Anastasio Somoza, one of our favorite Latin dictators, was not looked upon friendly by Ronnie and his friends. He called the counter-revolutionary Contras freedom fighters and compared them to America's founding fathers. In his attempt to get Congress to approve aid for the Contras, Reagan accused the Sandinista government of drug trafficking. Of course, Nancy Reagan had launched her Just Say No campaign at the time, but I guess she hadn't given the word to her husband. After his administration tried to mine the Nicaraguan harbors and got a hand slap from Congress, it turned to secretly selling missiles to Iran and using the payments, along with profits from running drugs, to keep right on funding the Contras. 50,000 lost lives later, the World Court would order the U.S. to cease and to refrain from unlawful use of force against Nicaragua and pay reparations. We refused to comply. The fact is, with most of the cocaine that flooded the country in the 80s, almost every major drug network was using the Contra operation in some fashion. Colombia's Medellin cartel began quietly collaborating with the Contras soon after Reagan took office. Then in 1982, CIA Director Casey negotiated a little memorandum of understanding with the Attorney General, William French Smith. Basically, what this did was give the CIA legal clearance to work with known drug traffickers without being required to report it, so long as they weren't official employees, but only assets. This didn't come out until 1998, when CIA Inspector General Frederick Hitz issued a report that implicated more than 50 Contra and related entities in the drug trade. And the CIA knew all about it. The trafficking and money laundering tracked right into the National Security Council, where Oliver North was overseeing the Contras war. Here's what was going on behind the scenes. In the mid-1980s, North got together with four companies that were owned and operated by drug dealers and arranged payments from the State Department for in-turn shipping supplies to the Contras. Michael Levine, an undercover agent for the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, later said that running a covert operation in collaboration with a drug cartel is what I call treason. The top DEA agent in El Salvador, Celerino Castillo III, said he saw very large quantities of cocaine and millions of dollars being run out of hangars at Ilopango Air Base, which was controlled by North and CIA operative Felix Rodriguez, He'd been placed in El Salvador by Vice President Bush's office as a direct overseer of North's operations. The cocaine was being transshipped from Costa Rica through El Salvador and on into the U.S. But when Castillo tried to raise this with his superiors, he ran into nothing but obstacles. Early in 1985, two Associated Press reporters started hearing from officials in D.C. about all this. A year later, after a lot of stonewalling by the editors, the AP did run Robert Parry and Brian Barger's story on an FBI probe into cocaine trafficking by the Contras. This led the Reagan administration to put out a 3-page report, admitting that there'd been some shenanigans when the Contras were particularly hard-pressed for financial support after Congress voted to cut off American aid. There was evidence of a limited number of incidents. It would be a while yet before an Oliver North note surfaced from July 12, 1985, about a Contra arms warehouse in Honduras. $14 million to finance came from drugs. Also in 1986, an FBI informant inside the Medellin cartel, Wanda Palacio, testified that she'd seen the organization run by Jorge Ochoa loading cocaine onto aircraft that belonged to Southern Air Transport, a company that used to be owned by the CIA and was flying supplies to the Contras. There was strong corroboration for her story, but somehow the Justice Department rejected it as inconclusive. Senator John Kerry started looking into all this and said at one closed-door committee meeting, "It is clear that there is a network of drug trafficking through the Contras. We can produce specific law enforcement officials who will tell you that they have been called off drug trafficking investigations because the CIA is involved or because it would threaten national security." All this, remember, while we're spending millions supposedly fighting the war on drugs, a phrase first coined by Nixon in 1969. If you want the ultimate double standard, here's what was happening simultaneously in 86. After Len Bias, a basketball star at the University of Maryland, died of a supposed cocaine overdose, even though the coroner found no link between his sniffing some coke and the heart failure, Congress proceeded to pass the Anti-Drug Abuse Act. Up until this time, through the entire history of America, there had been only 56 mandatory minimum sentences established. Now, overnight, there were 29 more. Even for minor possession cases, you couldn't get parole. They established a 100-to-1 sentencing ratio for cheap crack cocaine, used more by African Americans, over the powder variety favored by Hollywood types. This was at the same time we were knowingly allowing crack to be run into this country as part of financing the Contras. But we'll get to that in a moment. What became known as the Iran-Contra affair came to light in November 1986. We were selling arms to Iran, breaking an arms embargo, in order to fund the Contras. 14 Reagan administration officials got charged with crimes, and 11 were convicted, including Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger. Of course, Papa Bush pardoned them all after he got elected president. And do you think a word about drug running came up in the televised House committee hearings that made Ollie North a household word? Forget about it. The 1,000-page report issued by Senator Kerry about his committee's findings did discuss how the State Department had paid more than $800,000 to known traffickers to take humanitarian assistance to the Contras. The New York Times then set out to trash Kerry in a 3-part series, including belittling him for relying on the testimony of imprisoned drug-running pilots. The Washington Post published a short article heavy on criticisms against Kerry by the Republicans. Newsweek called him a Randy conspiracy buff, Wonder what they were snorting. But are we surprised? In 1987, the House Narcotics Committee had concluded there should be more investigation into the Contra drug allegations. What was the Washington Post's headline? Hill panel finds no evidence linking Contras to drug smuggling. The paper wouldn't even run Chairman Charles Rangel's letter of correction. That same year, a Time correspondent had an article on this subject blocked, and a senior editor privately tell him, "Time is institutionally behind the Contras." If this story were about the Sandinistas and drugs, you'd have no trouble getting it in the magazine. The list of government skullduggery goes on, and it's mind-boggling. Remember when Papa Bush ordered our military to invade Panama back in 1990? The stated reason was that its leader, Colonel Manuel Noriega, had been violating our laws by permitting drugs to be run through his country. In fact, Noriega had been one of ours for a long time. After Noriega was brought to the U.S. and convicted by a federal jury in Miami and sentenced to 40 years, filmmaker Oliver Stone went to see him in prison. There, Noriega talked freely about having spied on Castro for the U.S., giving covert aid to the Contras, and visiting with Oliver North. Noriega and Bush Sr. went way back to when Bush headed the CIA in 1976. The brief prepared by Noriega's defense team was heavily censored, but it did reveal significant contact with Bush over a 15-year period. In fact, Bush had headed up a special anti-drug effort as vice president called the South Florida Task Force, which happened to coincide with when quite a few cargoes of cocaine and marijuana came through Florida as part of the Contra support network. So why did we finally go after Noriega? Some said it's because he knew too much and was demanding too big a cut for his role in the agency's drug dealing. I can't exempt Bill Clinton from possible knowledge about some of this. A little airport in Mena, Arkansas, happened to have been a center for international drug smuggling between 1981 and 1985. That's when Clinton was governor of the state. Barry Seal, who had ties to the CIA and was an undercover informant for the DEA, kept his plane at Mena and smuggled between $3 billion and $5 billion of drugs into the U.S. Seal was also part of the Reagan administration's effort to implicate the Sandinistas in the drug traffic, though he was actually smuggling weapons to the Contras. He ended up brutally murdered by his former employers with Colombia's Medellin cartel in Baton Rouge on February 19, 1986. Among the articles found in Seal's car were then-Vice President Bush's private phone number. Clinton said he learned about Mena after that, in April 1988, even though the state police had been investigating the goings-on there for several years. In September 1991, he spoke publicly about all kinds of questions about whether he, Seal, had any links to the CIA, and if that backed into the Iran-Contra deal. But Seal's contraband in Mena generated hundreds of millions that needed to be money laundered, and his papers show that he dealt with at least one big Little Rock bank. Several inquiries into Mena were stifled. An IRS agent, Bill Duncan, told Congress in 1992, during the Clinton presidential campaign, that his superiors directed him to withhold information from Congress and perjure myself. Looks like Clinton may have been tainted by the Iran-Contra madness himself. Okay, the Reagan-Bush gang is gone, and Clinton is now president. It's 1996 when the San Jose Mercury News comes out with a remarkable 20,000-word series by reporter Gary Webb that he'd been researching for more than a year. It described a pipeline between Colombia cartels, middlemen, and street gangs in south-central L.A. that involved tons of crack cocaine. Webb's article featured Oscar Danilo Blandon, a drug importer and informant who testified in federal court that whatever we were running in L.A., the profit was going to the Contra Revolution. Blandon also said that Colonel Enrique Bermudez, the CIA asset leading the Contra army against the Sandinista government, was aware that these funds came from drug running. Except the CIA had squelched a federal investigation into Blandon in the name of national security. The crack was being funneled to a young new millionaire named Freeway Ricky Donald Ross, who supplied it to the Crips and Bloods and beyond. When Ross got nailed and went to trial in 1996, the prosecutors obtained a court order to prevent the defense from questioning Blandon about his CIA connections. All of which raised a huge question. How involved was the CIA in the crack epidemic then raging across our country? Well, you'd think Gary Webb should have gotten a Pulitzer. Instead, he got torn apart by the big media. In page one articles, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and L.A. Times insisted that Contra cocaine smuggling was minor and that Webb was blowing it all out of proportion. They made it look like Webb was targeting the poor CIA, when he'd never said that the CIA per se was arranging the drug deals, only that it was protecting the Contra dealers. In 2009, a new book came out that makes my blood boil. It's called This Is Your Country on Drugs, and among other revelations, it tells of how the Washington Post had facts at its disposal demonstrating that the Webb story was accurate, except they ended up on the editing room floor. That's because national security correspondent Walter Pincus made sure they would. Pincus, it turns out, had flirted with joining the CIA and is routinely accused of having been an undercover asset in the 50s, a charge the journalist once called overblown. Here's another example of the media's role in the cover-up. The L.A. Times, 2 years earlier, had profiled Freeway Ricky as South Central's first millionaire crack dealer. But 2 months after Webb's series tied Ross into the Contra network, the Times turned a whole new slant. Ross, the paper said, was but one of a number of interchangeable characters. So Gary Webb was basically drummed out of journalism by his brethren at the larger papers. Who gives our media these mandates to arbitrarily destroy someone's credibility, blackball them because they've written something controversial? I guess people forget the simplicity of the First Amendment. It's there to protect unpopular speech, because popular speech doesn't need protecting. In 2004, Gary Webb's body was found, and it was ruled a suicide. I call this a tragedy that should weigh heavily on the consciences of those who intentionally destroyed his reputation. Or maybe it was actually murder. Webb was shot twice in the head with a vintage revolver, meaning he would have had to have cocked the hammer of the revolver back after being shot in the head at point-blank range with a .38. It's a proven fact that the CIA's into drugs. We even know why. It's because they can get money to operate with and not have to account to Congress for what they're doing. All this is justified because of the big picture. But doesn't it really beg for a massive investigation and trials and a whole lot of people going to jail? This includes the big banks that allow the dirty money to be laundered through them. Let's take a longer look at the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or, as our current Defense Secretary Robert Gates once called BCCI, the Bank of Crooks and Criminals. As CIA Deputy Director 20 years ago, Gates was in position to know. But when U.S. Customs Commissioner William von Raab was getting ready to arrest some folks involved with drug money laundering at a BCCI subsidiary in Florida, Gates failed to disclose the CIA's own use of BCCI to channel payments for covert operations, which the customs chief learned about only later, and thanks to documents supplied to him by British customs agents in London. At one time, BCCI had more than 400 branches in 78 countries and assets of over $20 billion. Most everywhere, BCCI systematically relied on relationships with, and as necessary, payments to, prominent political figures. As a Senate report put it, the bank had started out in Pakistan in 1972, with much of the startup funding being provided by the CIA and the Bank of America. By the early 1980s, the National Security Council's man, charged with tracking terrorist financing, Norman Bailey, said, "We were aware that BCCI was involved in drug money transactions, but the NSC took no action." Probably because CIA Director Casey was relying on BCCI to distribute American assistance to the Afghan Mujahideen, who were fighting the Russians at the time. Except most of the aid went to the faction controlled by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was probably the leading heroin trafficker in the world. Pakistani President Muhammad Zia in 1983 let local traffickers put their drug profits into BCCI. John Kerry's committee came across the bank's role in drugs and started to investigate, received basically zero information or cooperation provided by other government agencies. BCCI was the seventh biggest bank on the planet when it collapsed shortly after the Soviets withdrew their troops from Afghanistan. The mainstream media had started reporting on BCCI's activities early in 1991. "The World's Sleaziest Bank" was the headline on Time magazine's cover story. Soon the Bank of England pulled the plug, and regulators started shutting down BCCI's offices in dozens of countries. It was also the largest Islamic bank, and one fellow said to have lost a lot of invested money when BCCI fell apart was Osama bin Laden. After that, to make up for his missing revenue, bin Laden started cooperating with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the Afghan warlord who was taking profits from drugs and putting them into Islamic terrorist movements. This brings us up to the present, and what's going on today in Afghanistan and Mexico. I'm going to rely first on a recent article by Peter Dale Scott called "Afghanistan, Heroin-Ravaged State." He says that's how we should think of Afghanistan, rather than as a failed state. One statistic he cites is that in 2007, according to our State Department, Afghanistan was supplying 93% of the world's opium, the illicit production of poppies, bringing in $4 billion more than half the country's total economy of $7.5 billion. But even though 90% of the world's heroin is originating in Afghanistan, their share of the proceeds in dollar terms is only about 10% of that. It's estimated that more than 80% of the profits actually get reaped in the countries where the heroin is consumed, like the U.S. According to the UN, money made in illicit drug trade has been used to keep banks afloat in the global financial crisis. So, who's making out like bandits? It's a familiar story. Drug trafficking is tolerated in exchange for intelligence. Simple as that. Here's what Dennis Dale, a former top DEA agent in the Middle East, said at an anti-drug conference a couple years back. "In my 30-year history in the Drug Enforcement Administration and related agencies, the major targets of my investigations almost invariably turned out to be working for the CIA." After 9/11, when the U.S. sent troops to Afghanistan that fall of 2001, the Pentagon had a list of 25 or more drug labs and warehouses in Afghanistan, but refused to bomb them, because some belong to the CIA's new NA, Northern Alliance allies. The CIA mounted its anti-Taliban coalition by recruiting and sometimes even importing drug dealers, many of them being old assets from the 1980s. Friends, families, and allies of Afghan President Hamid Karzai are heavily involved. It recently came out that Karzai's brother is not only involved with the drug trade, but has been receiving regular payments from the CIA for the last 8 years. Another of the traffickers, Marshal Muhammad Qasim Fahim, who was the country's defense secretary and maybe its next vice president. He was a general when the U.S. swept into Afghanistan after 9/11, worked closely with the CIA, and got rewarded with millions in cash. Except by 2002, the CIA was well aware that Marshal Fahim was into the heroin trade, long before the invasion and after becoming defense minister. He now had a Soviet-made cargo plane at his disposal that was making flights north to transport heroin through Russia, returning laden with cash. So what was the Bush administration's response? American military trainers would be directed to deal only with subordinates to Marshal Fahim. Gee, I'll bet they were clean. As clean as Karzai's brother, anyway. Pakistan's ISI intelligence service, which we'll be talking about again in terms of financing the 9/11 terrorists, is another big player. One expert says there is an ISI-backed Islamist drug route of Al-Qaeda allies that stretches across all of North Central Asia. Richard Holbrook, who is now Obama's special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, wrote in an op-ed in 2008 that breaking the narco state in Afghanistan is essential, or all else will fail. Holbrook also said that it's a complete waste of money to aerial spray the poppy fields, which costs about $1 billion a year, as this only serves to strengthen the Taliban and Al-Qaeda with the local people. Of course, Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon under Bush II fiercely resisted efforts to draw the United States military into supporting counter-narcotics efforts because they feared this would only antagonize corrupt regional warlords whose support they needed. Now, under Obama, supposedly 50 suspected Afghan drug traffickers believed to have ties to the Taliban have been placed on a Pentagon target list to be captured or killed. But at the same time, the CIA and the DIA now say that the Taliban are getting much less money from the drug trade than was previously thought, and that American officials did not believe that Afghan drug money was fueling Al-Qaeda. The question this raises in my mind is, then who's making off with the profits? Karzai's brother, Marshal Fahim, the Pakistani government, and some people in the CIA, maybe? The heroin trade took a dive at the beginning of this century because the Taliban put them out of business. When that poppy supply was put on hold for a while, isn't it ironic that some of the big banks tumbled? Is it because that dirty money wasn't getting laundered through their establishments? But apparently we think it's better to be in bed with the heroin producers than work with the Taliban. Now let's turn our attention closer to home and our neighbor Mexico. Even in the last decade, when it has become more fashionable to write about Mexico as a narco-democracy, few, if any, authors address the American share of responsibility for the staggering corruption that has afflicted Mexican politics. Drug trafficking in Mexico actually dates back to the Harrison Anti-Narcotics Act of 1914 that made it illegal here at home, coupled with Mexico's revolution, making its northern section pretty much ungovernable. The same year the CIA was formed, in 1947, the U.S. helped create Mexico's intelligence service called the DFS. Colonel Carlos Serrano, the brains behind that, was already connected to the drug traffic. Mexico soon became the main way station for smuggling heroin into the U.S. and Canada. Over time, the collusion only increased. Just as in Afghanistan, the CIA was consciously drawing on Mexican drug traffickers and their protectors as off-the-books assets. When Miguel Nazar Haro got busted in San Diego in 1981, the FBI and CIA both intervened because he was an essential, repeat, essential contact for CIA station in Mexico City. When DEA agent Enrique Camarena was murdered, the CIA got busy protecting the top traffickers behind it. During the 80s, CIA Director Casey helped keep drug lord Miguel Felix Gallardo safe because he was passing funds along to the Contras. Gallardo's Honduran supplier was estimated to supply perhaps one-third of all the cocaine consumed in the United States. Not surprisingly, narco-corruption in Mexico quickly spread to other agencies of law enforcement. By the time Carlos Salinas became president in the 90s, his attorney general's office was as much as 95% under narco control. DFS agents were regularly escorting narcotic shipments through Mexico and selling drugs they seized to organizations they favored. The DFS was carrying out high-level busts with the assistance of even higher-level traffickers. Operation Condor, carried out with the CIA's help, did the Guadalajara cartel a great service by winnowing out the competition. A new class of oligarchs, known as the 12 billionaires, sprang up under Salinas's policy of directed deregulation. Some of the privatized businesses got snapped up by traffickers in order to launder and invest the profits from their drug operations. Citibank helped the president's brother, Raul Salinas, hide his fortune in safe places, and Citibank's role would later be described as willfully blind drug money laundering. Now defunct Lehman Brothers was right in there too, helping Mexico's regional governor, Mario Villanueva Madrid, go into hiding after he got targeted in a drug and racketeering investigation. Beginning in the 90s, drug dealers in Mexico were taking charge of half of Colombia's drug trade into the U.S. While Mexico used to be just the transshipping point from South America, now it was a major producer and distributor. Numerous new drug cartels came into existence: Sinaloa, Los Zetas, La Familia Michoacana, and more, with its gangs even taking control of cocaine networks in many American cities and clandestinely growing marijuana on our public lands. Today, authorities figure that between $19 billion and $39 billion in proceeds from drugs heads back south every year from the U.S. Of course, the death toll figures on what's happening in Mexico's drug war are astounding. Between December 2006 and the spring of 2009, more than 10,780 people were killed. And most of the guns fueling the violence are coming from the U.S. About 87% of the firearms that Mexican authorities have seized over the last 5 years can be traced to here, many of them from gun shops and gun shows in the southwestern border states. And these are no longer simply handguns, but now military-grade weaponry and very serious ordnance. How come the manufacturers are not being held accountable for selling these weapons over the border? My wife and I have driven across the border 3 times, and nobody's even stopped us. I could have had a Hummer full of automatic weapons. Since Bush II and Mexican President Felipe Calderon announced their $6 billion Plan Mexico in 2007, with the bulk of the money going to military training and hardware, the production of Colombian cocaine seems to have actually increased. To his credit, Obama stepped things up on the drugs and guns front, threatening to prosecute any Americans doing business with 3 of the most violent cartels and looking to seize billions of dollars in the cartel's assets. I give Obama praise for renouncing the war on drugs phrase, on grounds that it promotes incarceration and not treatment. Before the election, Obama said, "I think it's time we take a hard look at the wisdom of locking up some first-time nonviolent drug users for decades. Let's reform this system." I'm waiting for him to follow through on that promise. To his credit, the Justice Department has released new guidelines that reverse a Bush administration policy. Now federal officers are instructed not to go after marijuana users or suppliers who are in compliance with states' laws on medical usage. But isn't it high time for complete reform of our drug policy? We've got a shadow economy happening, friends. 100 million Americans have sampled marijuana, and that includes almost half of all the seniors in high school. More than 35 million Americans have tried cocaine at some point, and almost as many have taken LSD or other hallucinogenic drugs. Meantime, we've got grows, or gardens, of pot springing up all across our western states on public lands, and that includes almost 40% of national forests. About 3.1 million marijuana plants were confiscated in national forests over a one-year period, September 07 to September 08, carrying a street value calculated at $12.4 billion. I mean, how stupid are we? Go back to Chicago and Prohibition, when Al Capone became more powerful than the government because we'd outlawed the selling of liquor. Legalize marijuana, and you put the cartels out of business. Instead, we're going to further militarize our border and go shoot it out with them? And if a few thousand poor Mexicans get killed in the crossfire, too bad. I don't get that mentality. I don't understand how this is the proper way, the adult answer, when they could do it another way. Eventually, after thousands more people get killed, they'll probably arrive at the same answer. Legalization. Because there's nothing else that will work. And legalization would go a long way toward giving us a more legitimate government, too. A government that doesn't have to shield drug dealers who happen to be doing its dirty work. There are clearly people in government making money off drugs. Far more people, statistically, die from prescription drugs than illegal drugs. But the powers that be don't want you to be able to use a drug that you don't have to pay for, such as marijuana. 13 states now have voted to allow use of medical marijuana. Thank goodness Barack Obama just came out with a new policy, stating that the feds are not going to interfere as long as people are following state law. That's a great step toward legalization. You can't legislate stupidity, is an old saying I used in governing. Just because you make something illegal doesn't mean it's going away. It just means it'll now be run by criminals. But is using an illegal drug a criminal offense or a medical one? I tend to believe medical, because that's customarily how addictions are treated. We don't throw you in jail for them. In a free society, that's an oxymoron. Going to jail for committing a crime against yourself. The government is telling people what's good for them and what's not. But that should be a choice made by us, not those in power. Look at the consequences when it's the other way around. What should we do now? The hypocrisy of our federal drug policy has to be seen for what it is. When millions of dollars from illegal drug sales are being used to fund government agencies like the CIA and being laundered through our leading banks, isn't it time to rethink this situation? The fact is, the war on drugs is killing and imprisoning our citizens, way out of proportion to how it's helping anyone. Revamping a criminal justice system that incarcerates thousands of people for using illicit substances is a necessity. Legalizing marijuana and putting a tax on its purchase, like we do with cigarettes and alcohol, would be a start toward truly dealing with our drug problem.